VentureCast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Well, hello, friends, and welcome to episode 133 of the Burden of Command podcast. I'm your host, Earl Breon. Today's guest is Patrick Burke, and he comes to us from our good friends over at C.S. Lewis Publicis & Company. Patrick is the managing partner at Burke & Schindler PLL and Concentric Wealth Management. He is passionate about helping entrepreneurs start, grow, manage, and build valuable businesses, and he has advised more than 200 successful startups. He is also an expert across multiple disciplines, including mergers and acquisitions, business financing, and deal structuring. He serves on the board of directors for SMS Holdings in Nashville and UASI in Cincinnati, and maintains Series 7 and Series 66 securities license. He's also the author of the new book, The 10 Biggest Business Mistakes and How to Avoid Them. And that's what we're going to talk about a lot during this discussion, are those 10 business mistakes and how to avoid them. And as you can see, Patrick comes to this from, the money standpoint of it, but he's got a lot of great insight into startups, into what it takes to be a successful entrepreneur. So this was a really good conversation. It's going to be valuable for anybody who's looking to either get into the startup or has a startup. And the advice he shares here will just be extremely valuable to you all. So with that, I'm going to shut up, get out of the way, let the stinger play, and let you get into this outstanding interview with Patrick Burke. Pat, thanks for joining us.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you, Earl.
Oh, I'm delighted to have you. Thank you for being a guest and being willing to have the conversation we're about to have, because I think it's a very valuable discussion we're going to have here, because, you know, especially as we're seeing coming out of this pandemic, people are choosing more and more to not go back to the daily grind and start their own businesses. So I think the 10 biggest business mistakes are something that's really important to get out right now. So again, thank you for being here then.
Yeah, I think it is timely, and I'm hoping that people read it and realize I'm not just kidding around. I've made 8 of these 10 myself, so I can tell you, while they're not necessarily deadly, they are costly.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, before we dive into these mistakes, I want to start you off where I start everybody. When you hear the phrase burden of command, what does that mean to you?
Well, I've been thinking about this quite a bit. I mean, and this is, I was a very poor employee, and actually before I was working for a CPA firm, a local CPA firm, and I'm both a lawyer and a CPA, and I had decided that I didn't want to work at this firm anymore, and I thought I wanted to go in and work at a law firm, and my brother was a managing partner at a large law firm, and I said, let me buy you lunch, I want to talk to you about this, and I got about 2 sentences into it, and he said, "I want to tell you something, Pat. I'm your older brother. I sort of stand in the place of our dad, because our dad had died when I was 14 years old, and my brother was 13 years older than me. So he sort of stood in loco parentis, if you will. And he said, you're a shoddy employee. Actually, that's not the word he used, but he meant that. It was a little more colorful. And he said, you're much better off on your own. So whether I liked it or not, I kind of had to be a leader, because I wasn't a very good follower. But it's, you know, of course, that was my choice. But I do think that there's, you know, what I would say, you know, sort of earmarks of good leaders. And I think that, you know, in the business world, you know, I think there's several tenets that I think make up a good leader. First off, you know, you have to treat your employees like real people and get to know and understand them, and understand, you know, their why. And, you know, of course, as the owner of the company, you know, you're the last to get paid. You know, nobody else had signed on to take entrepreneurial risk. So that's a critical piece of it. I also think it's helpful to have a particularly highly polished crystal ball. People are depending upon you to take your company, you know, beyond just where it is today and where it needs to tomorrow, because they want to have opportunities to grow and be part of an organization that thrives not only today but tomorrow and gives them an opportunity to have a career. I also think it helps to have be of good cheer, you know, have good humor. Things are going to happen. And, you know, if you take everything personally and if you get upset about small things, I think it makes for a very difficult work environment. I think we've probably all worked for people like that. And it's no fun. There's no reason why business, you know, should be, it's for most of us, if you're not in the medical field, it's not life or death. You just want to, you know, get through the day, do your best, the best possible job for yourself and your customers and move forward. I think also that best leaders have significant grace under pressure, and, you know, similar to my last comment, you just, you know, they seem to do better the tougher things get. And it's always interesting to me when an employee sort of makes their first mistake, and in an accounting firm, a lot of times those mistakes cost client money, and you have to, you know, own up to what you've done wrong and move forward. And they're great learning experiences, in my estimation. Also, I think business, being a business leader, you have to understand, I think you have to have a bias towards action. I think that, you know, back to my earlier comment about a pretty clear crystal ball, you got to be able to move forward and not be caught in the ready aim, you can't fire. And of course, a lot of that's associated with being good at assessing risk. And I don't want to say that entrepreneurs necessarily eat risk for breakfast, but they usually don't have it still on their menu by lunch. You know, they understand how to deal with risk, assess risk, and move forward. I'm not saying that the answer is always to move forward. Well, I guess you move forward. Sometimes you move forward by not doing it. In general, it's been my experience with entrepreneurs that you have to be sort of dial them back a bit, which is not always easy, and they don't always listen to me, but, you know, at least you need to be on record as having said that. So I hope that was a good response.
That was an absolutely great response there, and I loved all the way you broke all that down. And you know, as you were talking about those last couple of pieces there, you know, it kind of reminded me, you know, my listeners know I like to inject history whenever I possibly can, but it kind of reminded me of the kind of the dichotomy between General McClellan and General Grant. You know, for those who aren't aware, General McClellan was kind of in charge of the Union forces around the Potomac before Grant took over. And the main reason was is because he was kind of doing what Pat was just talking about here. He was prepare, march, drill. I think the famous quote from Abraham Lincoln was, General McClellan's assembled the finest army America's ever seen. Do you think he'd mind if I borrowed them for a little while? You know, and it was the thing, he would never do anything with them. And so when Grant comes along, he looks like a genius because he put all of McClellan's preparation into action. And I think that's kind of what you were getting at there with those last couple of pieces, right?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I often talk to entrepreneurs about their business, and clearly, most of them operate at the CEO level, and they're not very good at the, you know, I always think of entrepreneurs having two lenses. They have a wide angle lens that looks for opportunities and threats. And then they go down to a microscopic lens to deal with one or the other. Then they go back out to the ultra wide angle lens, and the area in between is sort of the area for middle management. And that's, most entrepreneurs are not good middle managers, don't hire middle managers, maybe that's McClellan. He was a good teacher, but he wasn't necessarily a great executor. So I'd say most entrepreneurs fall into the Grant category for sure.
Yeah, definitely. Well, and I like that. So let's go ahead and dive into the 10 biggest business mistakes and how to avoid them, because you'll touch on that a little bit here in mistake one. but it's buy or start the wrong business. So talk about that a little bit. Why is that a that seems like one that would be fairly easy to avoid, but why isn't it?
Well, I think it's a standard case of people really don't examine their conscience very well. You know, they hear about an opportunity and they think, oh, that sounds good. I think that person has done very well with his engineering company or with a particular product, and I think I can do that. And then they think they're smarter than the average bear. So I had a couple of partners a few years back, and actually I had a client who was had the rent to own business, so they would rent TVs and furniture and appliances, and they had a few stores in and around Cincinnati, and they were looking for an investor. And I decided that I put together a couple people, and we decided that we were going to invest in it, but we thought we had a better idea. We thought that we had a local apartment owner that owned several hundred apartment units in the city, and we thought, well, maybe we can sell directly through the apartment managers. We could rent to new tenants and to existing tenants, because we knew it was that group of people that apartment dwellers and people that, you know, weren't in places over long periods of time were the customers of the rent to own store. So we thought we, you know, even though we had no experience except they were a client for a couple of years, we jumped into that and we were just absolutely dead wrong. If an apartment manager could also run a rent-to-own store, then he wouldn't be an apartment manager. So we had absolutely zero rent thrill. So I look at a situation where I added no value to that. So although rent-to-own can be a very good business, and we have a client now that's got 25 stores, does very, very, very well, I didn't know enough about it. And I think just because something's a good business doesn't mean you're going to be good at it. So I always say, you know, I look at business as a three-legged stool. You know, there's sales, and there's production, and there's administration. And most entrepreneurs are successful when they're very good at sales and or production. If you're only good at administration, you know, that's not really – then you're better off buying a franchise. And there's nothing wrong with a franchise, but they – if you take on a franchise, you pick a Wendy's, for example, you know, they've got their recipes, they've got their logos, they've got their designs, and you know, they're constantly bringing out new products. So they've created the sustainable advantage, right? You don't have to do that. And with most businesses, the reason somebody can't create or execute a sustainable advantage is because it was a business they shouldn't have been in to begin with. Back to my rent-to-own story, if you will. So, you know, even if you're not the best sales guy or the best production guy, if you're second best at that and you've got good people ahead of you, that works too. But I just think too many people do not examine their conscience carefully enough to figure out what it is that they do well that they can actually add value to a business. Very common problem.
Oh, yeah. No, I love that. And I love these, you know, later in that chapter, you ask these 10 threshold questions. And I like these 10 questions, but there's one in here that sticks out particularly very prominent to me, and that is, can you lead people? And I think that's a very critical question for folks in business to ask and answer, because, I mean, especially if you have a decent amount of success, you're going to have to lead people at some point in time. So that's a pretty critical skill, right?
It certainly is, and really, it's probably one that is most prevalent in all successful entrepreneurs. And you know, where I find entrepreneurs sort of hit their own peak or maybe glass ceiling, if you will, is, you know, most businesses, as they say, you know, their personality cults up to the point of maybe 20 people or so. And then the 21st person doesn't know the founder as well as the top 20 did. So they're then sort of relying on corporate culture and process and metrics. And a lot of times the business owner was such a personality cult, and he had people, you know, or she had people dancing to his tune or her tune, and he didn't really have the processes in place. While they were good leaders, they really weren't very good managers. And I think that's, you got to draw the line there. And quite honestly, what I find is a lot of entrepreneurs, while they're natural leaders, they really need to hire managers, or at least early on, if they can't do that, they have to force themselves into that middle management role. And it's really kind of goes against their grain.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's really good advice. I really appreciate that, because, you know, it's true. I've seen too many folks who, you know, just because they have the great idea or whatever, they feel like they have to be the person. And sometimes it's a good idea to know what your weaknesses are and hire those people to fill in those gaps, right?
Oh, it is. I mean, famous book, The E-Myth, and, you know, just because you're good at making pies doesn't mean you're going to be good at running a company that sells pies. It's just, in fact, it's probably not that they're mutually exclusive, but, you know, it's why, you know, frankly, we talk about it later in the book, is most businesses really don't get beyond the lifestyle type business and don't really become growth businesses. And it's honestly, it's not generally, it's partly because of lack of capital and taking too much money out of the business. But oftentimes it's more about the owner's inability to see where their weaknesses are and to find the right person or persons to fill in those gaps to make sure that all the trains run on time. And it's a shame, but it's interesting in that it's usually at the point where the business begins to top out that I have the business come in, and business owner will come in, and I call this one chair in my office the Bob chair. It's the burnout business owner. And they'll come in and say, Pat, you just got to help me sell this, and I can't take it anymore. And almost always the conversation from there goes to what's driving them to this decision. And it's because they're doing a bunch of things that they don't add any value to. And, you know, they're processing payroll, or they're taking over the human resource function, or they're interfacing with their lawyer, and they don't really care for that, or they're spending too much time on the accounting aspect of it, and that's not something they add any value to. So it's, and I say, you know, who would buy this business? You know, are you some sort of sadist? You're going to sell a business when it's, you know, it's limping along. You know, this is no time to sell. You just can't, you know, paint the door and cut the grass and expect to get, you know, top prices. Buyers are smart, and they want a business that's thriving, and they want some business that has good management and leadership. So it's very tough to get past to move into growth business from strictly, you know, a lifestyle business, which is more or less, hey, I've got a good paying job here, but, you know, will this thing, does it have any sustainability beyond me? I'm not really worried about that. You know, that's the sort of typical mantra of a business owner of that ilk. And not that it should be. It really doesn't take that much more, you know, to be a growth business, except, you know, be a little more process oriented, maybe leave a little more capital in and hire a few people that see things differently than you and aren't afraid to create processes that, you know, that are unfortunately mostly trapped inside the entrepreneur's head.
Hmm. No, I like that. And I definitely want to unpack that lifestyle mistake too here a little bit more. But if you had one piece of advice for somebody to avoid mistake one, like how would you guide somebody towards being able to sit there and really answer that question? Is this a good or bad business? And, you know, I ask that, you know, knowing that the world we live in right now, you know, you got a lot of different marketing schemes out there. There's a lot of different products. You can buy this and become a sales rep for that company. And everybody's promising riches, get rich quick. And oh, by the way, we've got all these influencers out there who, you know, are making a business out of influencing people. Everybody sees these folks with these kind of like get rich quick kind of schemes, and they want to break off a piece of that Kit Kat bar, so to speak. How can you, what is the one question or tip that they should be asking, or tip do you have so they can say, hey, yeah, no, this is the wrong business for me?
Well, I'll, you know, find something you already know something about. You know the market. You know who the consumer is. You might have contacts in that market already. You know, you might understand something about the distribution channel. You might even understand about how to source something, how to make something. Anything that puts you a little bit ahead of the next guy is really the place you want to be. You're starting everything from scratch, it's very difficult, right? You know, you don't understand the market, you don't understand the product, you don't understand who the customers are. It's not impossible, but in general, I mean, a lot of times, I mean, if it's a young person with a startup, it's usually their idea and they're executing their idea. You know, you've got the middle-aged person who may have had a hankering their whole business to career to start a business, and that's fine. I mean, you don't, in that situation, you may have a kid or two in college, and you can't really afford to make a big mistake. So find an area that you've already done work in, and you know, if you're an architect and you want to get into the building products business, well, there you go. You already know something about it. You understand, you know, who your buyers are and who your sellers are. It's just difficult, unless it's your product and your great idea, to sort of, you don't want to buy somebody else's mistake, and you don't want to buy something where you're at the very bottom of the learning curve.
No, that's good advice. That's absolutely good advice. So let's talk about the lifestyle piece here, because, you know, I like the kind of the analogy, if you will, that you use in the book here. You said something about, like, if your lifestyle is going to the lake on the weekends, well, then you need an SUV business. But if your lifestyle is going to Paris, then you need a Gulfstream business. I like that, because I thought it was a very good visual way of putting it, because it's true, right? It's that probably helps you avoid mistake one, is also knowing what type of lifestyle that you want out of your business, right?
Well, I talk about it later in the book about, you know, it thinking too small is a mistake. Let's face it. You know, if you're going to own four Domino's franchises, you're not going to be buying a Gulfstream, right? But if you say, hey, I really like that, and maybe I could go to another city and buy four more. I just talked to a client of mine who owns a number of Wendy's, and they just decided to buy. They just put in an offer to buy 40 more. So you can go from quick serve food to owning your own Gulfstream if you'd like, but that isn't necessarily the goal. But, you know, have a goal that's suitable and try to stick to it. I mean, I think too many people, you know, if they haven't been an entrepreneur and they see the guy up the street who's got a successful, you know, you pick it, he's got a landscaping business and he drives a Range Rover and he belongs to the country club and, you know, they go on great vacations and you think, well, that's what I want to do. And a person starts a business, buys a business, and then they have some cash flow and, you know, maybe they were, this is two or three times more money than they've ever owned or never made before. And even though they've got a business that could be much larger, they become very enamored with the lifestyle and looking a certain way and over rewarding themselves is how I put it. I mean, nobody gets into business, you know, for entirely altruistic reasons, right? Everybody wants to make money. And I tell people, you know, reward yourself, but don't over reward yourself. You know, if you're putting a situation where if your business is starving because you think you have to buy, you know, a new Mercedes, then you've made a mistake. You know, you put a governor on your business, because it's become more important to you to look like you're successful than to actually be successful. And frankly, Earl, I mean, my most successful clients, I mean, money is really, I mean, it's only the scoreboard. I mean, they love to compete, they love to win, and, you know, you never know the level of their success, you know, in any fashion. They don't, you know, they might have, you know, a nice car, but they don't have four. They might go on a nice vacation, but it's, you know, they're not necessarily, you know, taking the family on a private jet to Paris for the weekend. I mean, that's just, they just don't. I mean, and if they did, they'd never tell you about it.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, I think that's great, because that's kind of, you know, Obviously, until I started doing this later on in my years, you know, one of the richest guys I ever met in my hometown, you know, the guy, he shopped at Walmart. He had a, you know, he had a nice truck, but it wasn't, you know, overly extravagant. And that's what you're saying. Like this guy, you know, he was super successful, owned a lot of land, owned a great business. But if you were from out of town and didn't know who he was, you'd think he was just an average Northeast Tennessee guy.
Right.
And, you know, and that was his thing. He's like, yeah, I could do all that. He goes, but, you know, I've got dreams for my grandkids. I'm not going to spend all their dreams on my Mercedes. You know, so I like that. And I think that's really a critical piece there, because we hear this, you know, a lot of folks get told, well, you got to fake it till you make it. You got to fake it till you make it. Well, that means I got to have the Armani suits and the Rolex watches and drive the sports cars, because I got to fake it till I make it. And that's how people really end up in upside down in a lot of trouble real quick, right?
Yeah, I don't, I you know, certainly there's certain, you know, industries where you need to look the part. You know, if you're, you know, we got a money management business associated with our accounting firm here. And, you know, and accounting law, money management, you know, you don't want to show up in a t-shirt and dungarees, right? They're, you're being judged partly about not just the steak, but also the sizzle. So you can't be unmindful that you have to present a certain image. But, you know, that's all part of, you know, showing up to play the game and having your helmet be the same color as everybody else's on your team.
Right.
You know, beyond that, it's not important. I would say that, you know, I don't have, almost all my clients are first generation business owners, and, you know, they are not necessarily overly enamored of looking a certain way, or they're just, they enjoy making, you know, it's, Cincinnati's a Midwestern place. People aren't overly showy, so they enjoy succeeding, but they don't necessarily enjoy pounding their chest. That's just sort of the way it is. Maybe in other places there's more pressure to look a certain way and do a certain thing, but not here in good old Cincinnati.
Yeah, no, Cincinnati is a nice town. I've interviewed quite a few people from Cincinnati on this show, and every one of them are kind of saying the same thing that you're saying here. You know, it's run business with a nice level head, and yeah, I agree with you. You definitely got to look the part. So yeah, no, I like that. You know, I think on this note, let's go ahead and segue into mistake three here, professionals. And this one, I like this, cause you talk about the need, and we've already kind of talked about this before, but kind of fill in some of those gaps and knowing when you can't do everything and when to bring the right person in that does, right?
Yeah. There's, in certain instances, and this is, you know, I think less prevalent because more and more people, I think, understand the need to have an expert. And there's no reason to, you know, run this race by yourself. You're much better off, you know, being, let somebody else be at the front of the peloton and you can tuck in behind him, right? There's certain maybe first-time entrepreneurs particularly where they're extremely price conscious and try to find, you know, they're using the tax preparer down the street to be their accountant and tax advisor, and they're using, you know, the guy, the lawyer that did their parents' will to set up their operating agreement. It isn't to say that those are the wrong people, but you know, you want to use somebody that's been there before and, you know, more likely than not has worked on businesses bigger than yours. You know, I always say, you know, a good accountant, a good lawyer, they can see around corners. You know, they know where what the next curve looks like, and they can warn you in advance to tap the brakes. And I would say that business is really, and as the book would indicate, it's like weekend golf, you know, unless you're a pro golfer, you know, you're not going to hit that, you know, that 190 yard five iron over that 80 foot tree time after time. You have to practice course management and, you know, the person who makes the fewest mistakes wins that match, and that's business. You know, you don't have to do extraordinary things. It's the old story of doing ordinary things extraordinarily well. If you can burn that into an entrepreneur's desk so that they see that each morning, I think that's probably a pretty good idea.
Yeah. No, and I like that. And I like that golf analogy there because, you know, I don't play golf very often because mainly I'm just not that good at it. But I will tell you, there was one time that I was actually pretty decent, and that was the only time I had a caddy. And it's yeah. a totally different game when you've got – golf is a totally different game when you've got a professional, like what we're talking about here, using the business analogy here. It's a totally different game when you've got somebody who knows the course and can help you with shot selection and help you to try, if you have any skill, which I don't, to shape the shot.
Well, it is funny. I have played – I don't play often either, but I have played at nice places where you have to have a caddy and they do know the course. And, of course, you ask for a club and they just shake your head. It's like, no, you can't hit that from here. You need to – you know, so you're asking for your 5 wood and they're handing you your 6 iron. It's like, So it's like, if you think you can get there from here, maybe you've done it once in the last 5 years, buddy. It ain't happening now. Don't even try. So yeah, I've had that experience. It is pretty funny, but that's what a good professional does for you. They don't let you make they'll manage the course. And as I always tell people, you don't have to be a world beater. You just got to beat your competition, and you better be wanting to beat your competition because they're thinking about it right now, and they're looking for a way to beat you. So don't be I think certain people have a certain amount of success, and they think, well, you know, nobody will catch me now. And it's like one of my favorite entrepreneurs said, I always believe there's somebody within 5 miles of me right now who's got a better idea than me, and he's going to execute it better, so I better get back on my horse and get to work. And I thought, good for you. And he's been super successful.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and that's that yeah, that's that mentality you got to have because it's kind of true, right? I mean, especially right now, again, with how fast things move and it's just getting faster with the internet. Yeah, people are always having the next best idea. No matter what the business is, somebody's always having the next best idea. So that's a great mentality to have. I really like that.
Absolutely.
All right, so I'm not going to go through every single one of these because I definitely want my listeners to go out and buy a copy of this book. But
so do I.
Well, and we'll get to that because, you know, listeners, okay. Again, I want you to go out. I really do want you to go out and grab a copy of this book, The 10 Biggest Business Mistakes and How to Avoid Them by Patrick Burke. And we'll have some information later on where to find the book and how to get a copy. But I think this is a really good... Especially if you're at that point where you are considering starting your own business. I mean, I think this is good if you already have a business. Maybe you've already made a few of these mistakes, but maybe you can come back and do a little course correction. But I think definitely if you're at that point where, you know, hey, maybe your business is one that is saying, oh, you got to come right back to work. Telework is over. You got to actually wear pants and stop watching Netflix. And then you're like, no, this is a
book. Well, I'll tell you what, I mean, it's, well, we're seeing it across the board. Part of our business is we do executive recruiting.
Yeah.
And a lot of people have decided that, you know, to your point early on, you know, they're not going to go back to work. They like the freedom.
Yeah.
And perhaps this is the time, you know, you see what the savings rate has been over the last 18 months, people didn't have a chance to spend much money. And so they've got something even more saved up. It's time to go out and maybe start that dream business, which is great. I mean, it's if you got that burning desire, you know, you should do it. You know, and it's not something. It's as I say in the book, it's nothing. If you fail, you fail. You know, it's only business. It's not personal. And maybe you find out that, you know, you weren't the risk taker you thought you were. That's okay too. I mean, a lot of people, you know, get into the entrepreneurial game and then decide later on they don't like it. They sell it and go back and find a job. And not usually, I would say. Although there are a group of people that I call accidental entrepreneurs who are, you know, I had a client years ago who the owner of the business came to him and said, if you would want to continue working here, we're selling this and either we're going to either sell it to you or somebody else. And he came to me scared to death, and he said, you know, I never thought for a minute I ever wanted to own a business, but I know based on it that I can run this, and I can find some, if you can help me find financing. And he turned it into a very, very successful business, and later sold it himself and made more money than he would have ever made in four lifetimes by just taking, you know, a bit of a risk, you know, even though he was, it was thrust upon him. And, you know, he ran it successfully for 20 years and did very well. But it's, you know, he on his own, he would never have done that.
Yeah.
And that's okay, too.
Well, yeah. No, I mean, those are those destiny type things, right?
That's right.
And those don't happen very often.
No, that's, yeah, that's the bluebird that flew in the window. It doesn't happen often at all.
Yeah. Well, so you kind of tying that all together there, right? So, you know, this, like I said, this is happening. You know, I've had a few people on here talk about it. We see articles in Forbes and HBR and all these things every day talking about how people are choosing to quit their job versus go back to work. And that means a lot of people are getting into this entrepreneurial cycle here. And I think this mistake four, if I'm going to play a little bit of Nostradamus here, and maybe you've already seen it happening, but I think mistake number four, partnering, is probably one of the big ones that we're going to see here, because it's like, you know, hey, Bob, I'm not going back to work. You know what? No, let's start a business. And it should be a little bit more than that, right?
Yeah. In fact, I wrote a whole book on it, and the book is called There Is No Us in Business. And, of course,
right,
there is a us in business. But, yeah, it is. I'd say it, apart from starting buying the wrong business, the second most common mistake is bringing on a partner that you don't need. And unfortunately, I'm afraid I have presided over as many business divorces as I have successful business combinations. And there's people just get, you know, for some reason, I don't know. And it's generally not necessarily risk, but it, by and large, I think entrepreneurs are, you know, lone wolves. And suddenly when it comes time to start the business, they want to go hunt in a pack. And it's like, you know, this is a, I always tell them, look, if you don't think that the ownership percentage in your business, your equity is going to be your most valuable asset someday, then you really shouldn't be getting into business, right? Yeah. And if it is your most valuable asset, then you should guard it with your life. But instead, what they do is, you know, my favorite story is a client of mine, before he met me, he had a very complicated process that he did with power plants. And there was a certain machining that it would help the power plant, instead of being shut down for days at a time, he could have it up and running in a day. Yeah. But it required a high-level machinist, and he's an engineer. And he made a machinist his 50% partner in this business. And as it turned out, they had to expand from Salt Lake City to Cincinnati and then Cincinnati to Reno. Well, in between this, the non-entrepreneur, the machinist, just wanted no part of all this risk and buying more equipment, renting more space. And they actually leased an airplane because they were flying these parts in and out. And so they had a buy-sell, and it was called a cutthroat buy-sell. And a cutthroat means you go to the meeting, one partner names the price, whoever is calling the meeting, and the other partner decides if at that price he's a buyer or a seller. So my client, whose business he designed, you know, he walked into a meeting. We walked into a meeting with both lawyers, and he didn't know if he was going to be walking out with 100% of the business or he was going to walk out with a check. As it turned out, he walked out with 100% of the business. He did very well with it, but he could very easily have lost his business in that meeting with somebody who didn't really understand risk. So I tell people that the gold standard is that you only take on a partner if that partner or that person has a skill that's absolutely positively necessary for your business, and that skill cannot be acquired for money alone.
Yeah.
It's something that's so unique and so valuable that they insist on and, you know, deserve equity, that's fine. But if you can pay for it, then please go out, you know, beg, borrow, use the family, friends, fools funding method, whatever it takes. But, you know, bring them on as an employee. It's I've just seen so many businesses go sideways, and even sometimes it just ends the deal. You know, it's not. In that case, you know, he bought him out and it was fine. you know, costs him a lot of money. But in many cases, the business just disintegrates, and neither one of them do well. So I'm very, very careful. You know, back to choosing the right professional. You know, when I have this conversation with somebody, it's they've never heard it before. Well, I was going to bring in my neighbor, and I said, well, you know, this isn't a golf game. You're not looking for a foursome. Yeah. It's not even tennis. You're looking for a partner to play. It's just you, and you know, take it from there.
Yeah, well, and I think that's it, right? Like, you know, working with some of the folks that I've worked with, and them being in some situations, you know, like that. That's usually that origin story, right? Is, you know, they're sitting around, they're hanging out, you know, in the basement, at the bar, watching a game, whatever it is. Like, man, would it be fun to start a business together? Yeah, man, let's do it. And yeah, they never think about like those things you talk about, like the risk tolerance, the risk management. Oh, and by the way, we're talking about business partners here. But if you're married, you better bring the wife into that equation as well and make sure she's on board with putting that stuff at risk as well, right?
Absolutely. I think it was David Rockefeller that said, better to gain a friendship through a business than put a friendship through a business partnership. So, you know, great to meet somebody in business and become a friend, but please, you know, if you need a dance partner, you know, go to a dancing lesson. Don't bring on a friend. Frankly, the friend thing hardly ever works.
Yeah.
Even when you're not necessarily friends before, but acquaintances, it's still very difficult. I mean, hey, there are exceptions. I think probably the one most common exception to that rule would be brothers that are in businesses. For some reason, that works better than brother-sister. That works even better than father-son or father-daughter or mother-daughter, mother-son. It's just brothers seem to get along pretty well. I think they punched each other so many times between, you know, ages 5 and 18, they've gotten that all out of their system. So it seems to work out.
No, that is actually interesting. I'd not heard that before, that you know, about the brothers thing. But, yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, because, you know, they say, what is the saying? I can't remember who said it, but the hardest ship to sail is a partnership.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Yeah. And that's probably it, because there's a lot of, I mean, I think that's the thing that people underestimate with a partnership is you two are never going to see eye to eye on everything. So it's inherently a lot of conflict resolution. And brothers have probably figured out conflict resolution better than any duo on the planet. So I think you're right there.
Yeah, it is. It's partnerships are very tenuous. It's interesting to me is that partnerships generally work best when the businesses do just so-so. You know, if the business is kind of go back to my lifestyle business, kind of a, you know, hey, you know, it's an architectural firm, let's say, and both guys are sort of having the same work ethic and, you know, they're not trying to kill it every day and they're doing okay. You know, on the other hand, if they're crushing it, it's probably because one or the other is really, you know, super talented at the job. And as a result, you know, they, you know, no matter what I tell people, most of them start off saying, I want to be 50-50. And it's like, you know, okay, but that's, you know, it's never, you know, the effort is never going to be 50-50, and the outcomes are never going to be 50-50. So there's going to be, when businesses do really well, there's always, you know, some sort of a, hey, this girl's not pulling their weight, this isn't fair. And then on the flip side, when businesses don't do well, then there's, you know, finger pointing, and oftentimes, you know, one person or the other can't make a capital call, and it's, you know, how are we going to handle this? And you know, you misused this money, and oh, it's no fun, you know. So you think about it, if you're planning on running just a so-so business, which I don't think anybody is, you know, you can be cavalier about bringing on a partner. Otherwise, it's, you know, be very, very careful.
No, I like that part, especially about the so-so business, right? Because it's like, had a friend of mine, he put it once, he goes, you know, nobody ever walks into the library and says, you know, I want to be smart, but I want to be Albert Einstein smart. Like, you know, nobody really goes into businesses, you know, hey, I want to be successful, but I don't want to be Jeff Bezos successful, you know.
Yeah, of course, everybody's, you know, and I don't want to say it's delusions of grandeur, but you should have extremely high hopes for your business. You know, as I always kid people when they come in with their business plans, and I say, you know, it's interesting to me. I've never seen anybody who lost money next year.
Right.
You know, that never happens, you know. It's like after the first year, it's going to be smooth sailing, baby.
I love it. Well, I think that's I think that's kind of a good cutoff point right now because, you know, we really got through the first four mistakes. That means, listeners, you know, even the guy from Tennessee can do this math. That means there's six more for you, right? So you're going to have to buy the book to find out more about those six other mistakes so you don't make them. So does that sound like a good deal with you, Pat?
That's a perfect deal. I mean, I hope that people understand that business is fun. It's not overly hard, and it's really being successful is really avoiding the big mistake. And that's, while it sounds simple, it really isn't all that simple. So the more information you have about what the mistakes might be, and a lot of them are not as intuitive as at all. And I think so. Buy the book and don't make the mistake, and be successful quickly without the pitfalls that I certainly, as I said, 8 of the 10, I fell in those pits myself, so I can tell you they're no fun.
I love it. Well, and maybe that was it, but before we wrap up, is there anything that we didn't really get a chance to convey to the listeners that you'd like to right now?
Well, so I'm a managing partner at Burke & Schindler. We're a CPA firm in Cincinnati. You know, we specialize in helping entrepreneurs, you know, start, run, and exit businesses. And, you know, we think it's fun. And I think it's, we will give you all the ammunition you'll need to not make the mistakes. People still make them anyway. They're headstrong, and that's okay, as long as they're not the kind that are existential. You can also learn more about me and my books on patrickburke.net. That'll feed you into the Burke & Schindler website as well. I've written four other books, including a book appropriate for teens that are just thinking about starting a business or understanding a little bit about business. It's called Swing for the Fences. So as a former lemonade stand operator, I wish I'd have read it back then, you know?
Yeah. No, I love it. Yeah, no, thanks for that. And I'll get those links in the show notes so people can get over there and find out more about those books. And, you know, again, listeners, there you go. I know I've got a few listeners that are in that kind of teenage demographic there, but we'll have to get a link to that because I think that's, you know, and maybe we're getting ready to start in a whole new podcast here with this, but I love that because I think that's one of the things that is really lacking in education right now. And it seems to be picking up a little bit of steam, but is these types of skills.
And it's interesting. I think, you know, when I first wrote the book, I mean, I think that I was on a local TV show here, and they were talking about, you know, what do you think of the misapprehension? And I think, you know, because kids are so busy now, they don't really have as much insight into what their parents are doing as they did before. I mean, my dad was a lawyer and a judge, and I understood. You know, we had clients come in. He'd be drafting their will in our dining room, and I'd see him, you know, write my dad a check on the spot or hand him an envelope with cash in it. So I understood how a business operated. And I think today, you know, perhaps kids think of mom and dad more like an ATM. You know, they understand the spending part of the revenue cycle. How it's earned is like, well, I don't know. I think dad just puts money in the checking account and everybody else takes it out.
Yeah, no, I mean, and you might be right, but yeah, no, I like it. And, you know, it reminds me of the bubble pop in 2008. And there was this whole thing about kids not being able to get those opportunities in like the fast food industries and things like that, because, you know, people, you know, in their middle ages or maybe even in retirement, were taking McDonald's jobs and all that good stuff.
Yeah.
this was a great opportunity for those kids to learn and maybe leapfrog and start their own businesses, right?
Yeah, I just absolutely, and I think it's important for kids to deal with other adults besides their parents. I mean, I learned a lot driving a truck and working construction, and you know, understanding, you know, growing up in a household where my dad was a lawyer, my brother was a lawyer, so you think everybody, you know, all the smart people on the planet are doctors and lawyers, and they're not. You know, there's some super, super smart people in business that maybe didn't go to school but are very clever in how they've made money and how they grow businesses. It's dealing with entrepreneurs is a blast. I feel blessed to have this opportunity to do it every day.
Love it. Love it. Well, Pat, thank you very much for spending this last about 50 minutes or so with my guests and with my listeners and myself. This is a great conversation. I really appreciate you having it with us.
Thank you, Earl. I appreciate the opportunity. I go out there, make money, avoid mistakes, have fun. Nothing wrong with it.
Love it. Say that again. There's nothing wrong with it.
That's right.
Yeah, you know, I think that's the thing. Like, success gets kind of a bad rap. People feel that you got to be kind of like evil and backstabby to be successful, but it's not true.
Well, and I also think, you know, business is not a zero-sum game, right? If somebody else is successful, he's not eating or she's not eating off your plate.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, more power to them. I mean, I've got so many clients that are so much more successful than I am, and it's, you know, at least financially. And I think it's great. You know, that's good for them. It doesn't have any consequence to me except, you know, I've got a great client who I can brag about some of their successes as being a small part of it.
Yep, exactly. Love it. Love it. And listeners, thank you for being with us for these past almost hour here. I know you got a lot of value out of it. I'm going to push the book again, The 10 Biggest Business Mistakes and How to Avoid Them, authored by Patrick Burke. Definitely click on those links in the show notes there and go check out what Pat does, check out his other books. And, you know, if you have any comments, questions, or concerns for me, burden.command@gmail.com. That's burden.command@gmail.com. Just reach on out. Let me know if you have any guest ideas, if you have any comments, if you have anything you want me to get to a guest, anything, just reach out at that email address. Keep rating, reviewing, subscribing, and sharing the show. It helps all of my great guests like Pat get their messages spread further and reach more ears and get more of their books and great content in hands to help make a positive change in the world. And you taking that responsibility serious means a lot to me, and I really appreciate you all for doing that. And with that, thank you all one last time, and I look forward to speaking with you again in the next episode.
Are you a fan of classic cinema or a young person who wants to discover the best films of all time? Do these legendary movies still hold up?
On the Generation Film Podcast, two guys who grew up when movies dominated the culture share a great film with a panel of young movie lovers and see how it plays for today's generation.
We discuss changes in storytelling, styles, representation,
the making of each film, its initial reception, and how its meaning has changed over the years.
Join us as we explore cinema classics across generations on Generation Film.
Electric acid. Welcome to Tuning Into Sound Wellbeing, where we harmonize your mind, body, and soul. I'm Amanda, your sound therapy expert.
And I'm Stephen, the curious explorer uncovering the mysteries of sound.
Together, we explore vibrations, frequencies, and the power of sound therapy and tuning forks.
Discover ancient wisdom, reduce stress, and tune into a healthier life. Subscribe to Tuning Into Sound Wellbeing today.
Electric acid.